If you're with us now, this is a re-airing of this morning's State of Nevada program. We will not be taking calls. If you have questions or comments, you can email son@knpr.org or leave a message on our Facebook or Instagram pages at Nevada Public Radio. From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. It probably doesn't feel like it yet, but next week's forecast might see temperatures start to dip below triple digits in southern Nevada. For northern Nevada, highs could top out in the mid-80s. It's the first sign that Nevada's often brutal summers are starting to break. It also means it's time to start thinking about planting again, both for the dinner table and just because it's fun or relaxing, or whatever you get out of digging out of the dirt. Fortunately for us, here to answer your gardening questions is the host of KNPR's Desert Bloom podcast, Norm Schilling, the president of Schilling Horticulture and Mojave Bloom Nursery. Norm, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
All right, let's just jump right into it. The weather is starting to change. What are you doing in your yard right now?
Oh, I've undertaken a project of cleaning up a bunch of pots on the patio. You know, some of the plants haven't been looking that good. A couple of the pots are empty, so I'm finding new plants. I'm getting some different rock mulches to dress them up. So it's been a little bit neglected. I had a project with a couple of my guys, and we went out there and we just played with potted plants. And then I go to my nursery because I get a really good discount there and pick up some cuties and bring them home and fill it in.
So this time of year, people are still dealing with the heat of summer in their yards. So let's talk about how to diagnose what's wrong with a plant. If something's wilting or turning yellow, walk us through that process and how people at home can figure out what's going on with their plants.
Okay, so wilting occurs. So think of wilting like a balloon. A balloon fluffs up with air pressure. Well, the turgor, the stiffness of a leaf, is water pressure. So if a leaf wilts, that means it's not got enough water pressure in there. And the challenge now, well, you think, okay, well, it's not enough water. The problem is if it's too much water, it exhibits the same symptom. And here's why. If there's too much water in the soil, there's no oxygen. The roots need oxygen so it can't to pick up the water. So if it stays too wet, it's not pulling up enough water. So how do you know? You reach your finger down in there. Or you get a screwdriver, you bang a screwdriver. Screwdriver is going to go way easier into, until you hit a rock, into moist soil than into dry soil. So water works as a lubricant. But if you can even just dig down 3-4 inches, get your hand in there and see how much water it's getting. That's a big part of it. The other thing with the diagnosis, if leaf tips are browning or the leaf margin, the edge of the leaf is browning and the center is staying green, it's likely to be an issue with not getting enough water long term. On the really hot days, it's trying to pull up enough water. It can't get enough. And so the tips of the leaves, the edges of the leaves, the parts further out, die off, turn brown, dead tissue. If, however, the other issue is sunburn, and leaves can get sunburn, as can trunks, but with the leaves, what happens, it's more of a faded patch, right? And you'll see that patch actually more likely facing the west or the south side. And sometimes you pull one leaf back and the leaf underneath is yellowed, but you pull the leaf above it back, you can see where the part that was shaded out by the other leaf is still nice and green, and that's a dead giveaway. And then there's nutrient deficiencies, right? Intervenal chlorosis, where the veins stay dark green, the tissue in between turns yellow, is most likely iron. Iron's the big one. And here's the interesting thing. There's a lot of iron in our soils, but the plants can be iron deficient because at high pH, the iron becomes chemically bound. So chelated iron is what you want to use. And you want to read the label. Some of these chelated irons that are being sold have like 1.5% actual iron in them. And you want something that is, you know, 50% or even 100% pure iron. The time to apply iron is early in the year, February, right before new growth occurs. It's really critical to get that iron in before it grows. And then it won't green up the existing leaves, but new leaves will have that iron resource. So there's a wide range of different things, and you can do research on all these different things. And look at the images on Google for sun scald, for not enough water, and you'll get a better understanding.
Mosquitoes are everywhere right now, and while we know they can harm you and I, can they actually harm plants?
You know, not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't make me dislike them any less.
Me neither. So what should people do? You know, if you're gardening regularly, you're definitely watering regularly. There's probably some standing water somewhere in your garden. What can people do to make sure keep those mosquitoes away?
Well, it's a countywide problem now, and it's mm-hmm. As temperatures have increased and our winter temperatures have increased, we're having more of a mosquito problem. I don't have any standing water, I'm glad to say. I've really searched because I've had quite a few mosquitoes. I get bit pretty much every evening now. And they're little tiny guys. They're different than the old ones, you know. They're really hard to even spot. So there was a recent article that came out just this past week, I think from NBC News, about Las Vegas specifically and the mosquito problem. And apparently part of the problem is that we're not coordinated in our efforts. And when we're not coordinated, you know, one entity is using one approach, another entity at another approach at a different time. If we could bring all those efforts together, we would probably have a more successful campaign against mosquitoes.
Now, I'll tell you, in my garden this year, I had quite a deal with aphids, especially going all over my squash plants. Really didn't seem to attack anything else, but really enjoyed going after those squash blossoms. You know, other than pouring as much diatomaceous earth on there as I possibly could, you know, what else do you suggest for especially something like aphids, where it's not necessarily going to kill your plant, but it could really, really decrease your yield in the garden?
Right, right. So they're little piercing, they have piercing, sucking mouth parts, and a couple aphids, no real damage. But they reproduce really, really quickly. They can reproduce asexually every 20 minutes. And my understanding is when a female aphid is born, she's already pregnant. So, I mean, the rate of growth of a population, it can be explosive. Now, the first choice, the easiest choice is to just spray them off with a good strong blast of water. They drown easily. Don't use pesticides, because when you use pesticides, you're often killing the predators, and the predators have a much longer, slower life cycle. So you get rid of the predators, and now the aphids explode even more. So blast them off with water. The next really good option is to bring in predators. So you can buy ladybugs here locally, and if you do that, you put them out at night, you moisten the garden so they have something to drink, they're more likely to stay, but a lot of them are going to leave. The predator that I found is really, really effective is lacewing larva. Mm-hmm. And you can get it in different forms. There's a company called Rincon Vitova, RINCON-VITOVA. And they're out of California. They're an insect factory. And they're really good at helping you solve insect problems with predators. And they'll guide you. But lacewing larvae are the little light green insects you see flying around your porch late at night, and they have their wings folded behind them. They lay an egg on a filament. Ants hate them because they milk aphids, right? So they'll try and kill them. So it's on a filament. The ants walk by. They don't see the egg a little bit above them, I guess. And then it hatches into this like little miniature alligator, and it has 7 larval stages, and it has pinchers in front, and it'll walk a mile and eat 100 times its body weight before it becomes an adult, which then feeds on pollen. So if you have flowering plants in your garden, as a variety of plants, you're much more likely to keep them in your garden as part of your pest control program. And they're not very expensive, so you can call Rincon Vitova or go online, order some, and then release them. And you scatter them about. You can get them in different forms, and they'll guide you in the application of them. Don't use pesticides. So water, I guess the last choice would be soapy water, but the soapy water can also kill predators. So water or predatory insects, particularly lacewing larvae.
We're taking your gardening calls. Horticulturalist Norm Schilling is with us. The number is 702-258-3552. That's 702-258-3552. You can also email us at son@knpr.org. Norm, we get this question very often, and you know, it does seem like it is such a bear to deal with Bermuda grass.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So let's talk. You know, I've heard it likened to bamboo in many ways because it just seems unstoppable. So, as somebody who has to deal with this professionally, how do you stop it?
Chemically. So that's one of the very few times that I'm willing to break out a pesticide. So glyphosate is the active, used to be the active ingredient in Roundup. They changed the active ingredient, so I haven't used the new formulation on Bermuda. But the basic premise is Bermuda is a warm season grass. It grows actively. You want to apply a systemic herbicide that the plant will take in and send down into the root system. For it to take it in, it has to be actively growing. The healthier it is, the better you can kill it. It's counterintuitive, right? But I'll do what I can to get it nice and green, turn it into the best little lawn. And if you have little patches of it, mm-hmm. you know, you actually cut them down with a weed eater or hand prune them back, and the new growth is going to be more receptive. Right. And then you get it nice and healthy. You even give it a little light dose of fertilizer, get it nice and green, cut it down one last time, wait about a week and a half, 2 weeks for that new growth to emerge, and then shut the water off a couple days beforehand. You mm-hmm. mix up the glyphosate, you add a little bit of like per gallon, 4 tablespoons of vinegar or lemon juice, and that makes it even more receptive to it. And then you spray it. And if it's in other plants, you either need to move the other plant out of the way, which you can do with a shrub or something. But if it's growing in a grass plant, you know what? It's a casualty that comes along with getting rid of the Bermuda. And Bermuda is like my number one target. It mm-hmm. will just take over a garden. It'll take over a space. If you're infested with Bermuda all over the place, then choose an area of that you want to do first, a smaller area. Do that this year, and then next year maybe do a couple areas. If you go to shillinghorticulture.com and click on a tab that says resources, there's a link to how to kill Bermuda, and it's a couple-page document, and it spells all this out in more detail.
Now let me ask you, there are some products, things like Ground Clear, that are used for, you know, if you never want something to grow in a particular location again. My concern with using something like that, because I've seen it used around patios, around living spaces where you just don't want to see weeds grow. How long does that stuff last? And is that, I mean, how far does that move? Was it going to transfer far if I were to pour it, you know, right along the baseline of my house?
You know, I'm not sure. I'd read the label and then do some research online. There's a few pesticides that I use. I avoid them. I would not want to use a product like that because, you know, I don't want weeds there. But you know what I would like there? Some little flowering perennials. And some of those will reseed themselves. And so if you're poisoning the ground, they won't reseed, right? And depending on how mobile it is in the soil, it may affect plants that you actually dig a hole and plant them. So, you know, I've got a half acre and I don't have a weed problem. That's because I have two philosophies in combating weeds. One, I do it in small sections. Nothing will kill your love of gardening more than spending a day weeding, right? Mm-hmm. So you set a 10-minute goal and you set the timer on your phone and you go out there and you weed for 10 minutes in an area and you made progress. You can actually see it and it's really affirming, right? And when I do 10 minutes, I'm going to give myself 5 bonus minutes, you know? And then I go in with a sense of accomplishment and I do it again in a day or two or three. The one thing, though, is I want to get them before they go to seed. Because then I'm eliminating the weeds for next year. Some of them are really obvious when they go to seed. Little plants like spurge, which is a really common ground cover weed mm-hmm. that has milky sap, they have really tiny flowers, really tiny seeds, so it's hard to tell. I go after those as soon as I see them. So I'd really try and be proactive about it. And the other thing is, when it rains, when you have moist soil, the weeds are going to come out much better. And finally, there's a tool called a leshy digging tool, L-E-S-C-H-E. And it's steel, it's forged steel. I've had mine for 35 years, right? It'll never break on you. And you just go down next to that weed, I mean, an inch or two away, and you just pry up on the soil. It loosens the roots. And you can actually just very gently with your forefinger and thumb pull it out, the roots come right out. It's so satisfying, right? So there are a number of different strategies, but I think the most important one is to not kill yourself doing it. Stretch it out and then enjoy life.
Since we're talking about flowers, for roses, what's usually the best way to water? Once, twice, more times per day, and for how long?
Once a day. If you water too frequently, what happens is you're saturating the soil, and roots need oxygen to pull up water. So if you, when you irrigate, you drive all the oxygen out. It's saturated, but then the oxygen starts to penetrate back in. If you water too soon, you're not getting much oxygen penetration. The roots are up near the top of the soil. They'll dry out more quickly, and they're not getting as many nutrients. So once a day, now as hot as it is, especially here in Southern Nevada, although I know you guys are getting pretty hot too, you know, water every day. Now, they say you can't water on Sunday. Watch your roses. If they show any sign of wilting, water them. Get your hose out there. That is legal. And by the way, you are able to water. This is SNWA rules. You can, if you plant something new, you can water for a while on a daily basis. It was 120 last year on Sunday, mm-hmm. which is the day you're not allowed to water for whatever reason. But it, as far as how long to run, it depends on the application method, right? Emitters have, drip emitters have various outputs. So if I'm watering with a 2 gallon per hour emitter, I'm gonna probably do about 45 minutes. I want to put about a gallon and a half of water down. That's going to get me good deep penetration. That water's going to move laterally through the soil. And the other thing is, don't just put the emitters at the base of a plant. If a plant grows to 2 feet around, it probably has a root system, if the water resources are there, that'll extend out 3, 4, 5 feet. Right? So add some extra emitters in between your roses. That's going to give it more wetting area. It's going to give it more resources. And the other thing, use mulch, especially an organic wood chip mulch, which is going to help conserve the water, but it's also going to slowly, as it breaks down, nutrify the soil. So figure, you know, so going back to how long, so I said a gallon and a half. With a 2 gallon emitter, it's 45 minutes. If it's 1 gallon, I'm going to water for an hour and a half. Those little shrublers, those little streaming devices that are adjustable, that's much harder to gauge because they're not at a fixed rate. So usually with those, it's like 15, 20 minutes. It just depends on how much water is coming out.
We got a call from Kathy on line one. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you.
You had a question about ground cover.
I do. I was in Santa Fe over the summer, and we went to the botanical garden there. It was beautiful, and
awesome.
They had a variety of ground cover called Veronica. And I'm wondering if there might be, I think the one of the workers there mentioned that there's a Turkish variety that might work in Las Vegas, but I'm just curious, Norm, if you have any suggestions on that.
No, I don't. So that's because I think many years ago it was tried at the Desert Demonstration Gardens, but I don't recall ever having seen Veronica grown successfully in this climate. So it's probably too hot here. However, there are varieties of plants. So some of these people at botanical gardens especially are very knowledgeable. And if there's a Turkish variety, get a little bit and try it out. And then call me in a year or two and let me know how it worked out. Because honestly, Kathy, I learned so much from my clients and customers. And, you know, so it you can probably get little starts online and just get 4 or 5 of them. Pick an area and see how it does, but give it a full season. The other thing I might suggest is, you know, do a little research online. And I found a website called Dave's Garden, where people from different areas, they say, well, this person's from Phoenix or this person is from wherever. And they give feedback. You can ask the question and they give feedback about that specific plant, or you can look up that specific plant and see what people have wrote. And so, you know, the information from St. Louis or something is not going to be as applicable, but somebody's growing it in Phoenix or even Las Vegas, then you can pick it up. The other thing is playing with plants. Just go ahead and have fun with them. Try it out. If it doesn't succeed, maybe try it a second time, give it more shade or something. A little research goes a long way, but death is part of gardening, and we need
yes,
to accept that. Oh, yeah. So, you know, just go ahead and have fun with it. Try it out. Maybe even just get 2 or 3 plants, 1 plant. See how it does, and then build on your success, hopefully.
Norm, we got this email from Skip. They write, many of us want a sustainable native landscape that is vibrant, colorful, and a delight to the eyes. But when the bulk of expert advice comes from growers in other states, how is anyone to know what really does well here in our climate? Mojave Bloom Nursery has a great selection, but then even they have limited information about heat tolerance, water requirements, and bloom time. Where do you suggest they look?
Online, or thank you very much for mentioning Mojave Bloom. Mojave Bloom is built or was founded, the primary intent in starting that nursery was to find and bring in those plants that are hard to find at the big box nurseries and to not carry the stuff that other nurseries do but typically doesn't do well here. The thing about natives, a lot of them are really hard to find. Growers don't grow them much because they don't sell. There's not enough demand. As demand picks up, hopefully supply naturally will increase. The folks at Mojave Bloom, whom I know well, will give you answers. And if you say, well, what about bloom time? If they don't know the answer, they can look it up with you, right? And that's, we really want to be a community resource. And that includes informational stuff. I think we might be doing a class in the near future on natives. At least we should. And we do offer classes and different, we have some outside groups come in, like Outdoors Nevada, to present pretty much every weekend. And just look us up online or follow us, and you can get that information too. So you're more likely to find it, I think, at Mojave Bloom than anywhere else in town. Also, you can order them online. Now, that's going to be more expensive, and the quality of plant might be more iffy, but honestly, they're just hard to find. The other thing about natives, though, I love our native species. Creosote plays a really beautiful role in my garden and others. Globe mallow is awesome, but a lot of these native species like brittlebush actually really tend to die back in the summer unless you give it quite a bit of water, right? There are other really, really drought-tolerant species from other deserts that you can mix in with our true natives to create a more lush garden. If you want to be a purist and go all native, that's awesome too.
That's Norm Schilling of Schilling Horticulture. They're taking your gardening questions. We have a question even about creosote right here.
Oh.
Is it possible to use creosote to make a hedge, a privacy hedge?
Yes, but no. I wouldn't use it that way because it tends to be an open plant. And if I sometimes this stuff gets a little personal. If I saw a creosote hedge, I think I'd shudder. You know, creosotes are so beautiful in their natural form, and they show these really dark, almost black stripes on the stems. And if you hedge it, it will get more dense, but I don't think it's ever going to become a really dense plant. That being said, give it a shot. Because the thing is, if you're hedging on a regular basis, and one of the advantages of that one of the ways creosote would fill this role well is it has small leaves. The best hedge plants have small leaves because when you shear it, you don't see as much damage to the leaf. If it's big leaves, you see all these jagged cuts in it and slices. So when you hedge a plant, what happens is you take off all the growing tips, and the growing tips below start growing in and filling in, and then you hedge it again. And so it can really start to get dense right on the edge. It'll be very open and airy on the inside. So if you want to keep it at 2 feet, keep it at 2 feet.
We have this call from Frank in Las Vegas. Again, apparently everybody's having problems with mosquitoes this year. Wants a little advice on how to handle them. Franklin, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good, good. I run a pest control business. I just wanted to get your opinion. I've been noticing that mosquito years, I've been doing this 26 years, have never been here. In the last maybe 3 to 5 years, I would say that they start coming in. But we have to advise our clients to all water still, you know, around your property or in your pool, please keep it clean. And still, we're still having the issue. Now, when I do sit outside at night, I'm still getting bitten.
Yep.
And I have the products. I'm wondering, now, is this going to be a problem from here on out?
Well, like I said earlier, it depends on how our community acts and our institutions, if they can get their act together. And I'm not trying to criticize them too much, but it really needs to be an area-wide approach. If one's doing left hand's not doesn't know what the right hand's doing, it needs to be coordinated. I guess, you know, I want you to call in and tell us how to take care of them. But here's what I do know is the new species, and I don't remember the name. It's like a gypsis or something. It can propagate or reproduce in very shallow water. So everything you can do to get rid of standing water. The other thing that just occurred to my mind as you were asking the question, one of my favorite things is going outside in the evening and watching the bats come in. And I'm up near Sunrise Mountain, so I might have more of a population than elsewhere in the valley. But bats are really, really beneficial. And as you watch them, they'll just be moving in one direction and all of a sudden turn really sharp to the, you know, they're excellent at catching flying insects. And they have super sensitive sonar or radar or what, I think it's sonar, that will pick up those small flying insects and they'll swoop in and take some out. I'm like mosquito bait, right? I mean, wherever I go, one of the first guys to get really bit up, right? I get about one, if I get one or two in an evening, I'm like, hey, this is pretty good. Sometimes it's five or seven. I've taken to wearing a very light robe if I go sit outside. And the truth of the matter is a lot of them are inside. I don't know how they're getting in. I don't know where they're coming from. So it is something perplexing. Actually, I guess the other thing I'd really consider doing, and I should have thought of this, I might contact Rincon Vitova and see if there's any predators that they have that might go after mosquitoes. It might, you know, you want to get them in their adult stage, because if you can find them in their larval stage, you can just get rid of the water. There are some pesticides that you can apply to water, if there is standing water, that will kill the larva in it. So maybe there's a case where it's a common, like an old swamp cooler or something, you know, but I don't know. It's prevention, and unfortunately you can't get your neighbors necessarily to join in that prevention.
Norm, switching gears, it is the fall. Let me ask you, is now the time to start thinking about planting trees?
Yes. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, in my mind, it's always time to start to think about planting trees. But the ideal season really is the fall for planting, right? Now, you can plant even now, and, you know, you just give the plant some extra water if it's a more sensitive tree and you're concerned. A really good tool is to have some shade cloth, like 30% shade cloth or even 50% around in nice big swaths. And if you have a plant that you're concerned about, it's a new plant going in the ground, what you do is you drape it over it, and then you use those big binder clips, and you use those binder clips to actually attach it directly to the end of of a growing branch, the tip of a branch, or onto leaves. And so the tree itself holds it on itself. And that's going to really reduce a lot of the heat stress on those new plants. Now, you know, gardens evolve, and the best gardens are really thoughtful undertakings. Doesn't have to be all thought out beforehand. The trees are the backbone of the landscape and the biggest long-term investment. The younger the tree is when you plant it, the quicker it establishes, the quicker it starts growing. So they really are a better investment. They just take a little bit more patience initially, but they will actually catch up to and surpass older planted plants. But the key is put a plant where it wants to be, give it room to grow, and then drink wine. If you have a well-selected tree and it's got room to grow, you know, you've really reduced the potential for problem and the potential for maintenance, especially size-wise. When, you know, most plants, I don't want to prune for size pretty much ever, but trees, if you want to, you get a tree that's too big, size control done well is really time-consuming. And if it's not done well, it's devastating to the plant. So I just want to say this, man. Don't plant Palo Verdes, don't plant mesquites in a little front yard or big acacias, right? Not only will they overwhelm the place and get on your house and require a ton of pruning, if they're halfway close to a hardscape, a sidewalk or the walkway or your driveway or whatever, they break it eventually. It takes time. So now you've invested 5 or 10 years, and now it's breaking your stuff, and you know, you got to cut roots. Those roots help stabilize it. So just really pay attention to the mature size of plants. And that does require research. All the time, I'm pulling up on my phone, put the species name in there, mature size, and see what the different sites are telling me. And I'm figuring, okay, 3 to 5 feet, this is what I'm going to plant on, right? Whatever it is. And then there's some trees that require more maintenance, some that are less. But that's a whole nother topic.
Chris from Las Vegas has a question about ash trees. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I have a very mature ash tree, and it's surrounded by grass. We all know in Las Vegas, SNWA is hounding us to get rid of our grass, and I've been told by people I trust that it won't survive the transition to desert landscape. What do you think?
Do you know what kind of ash it is?
I don't.
Okay. So, you know, the three big ashes here in Southern Nevada are Fantex, Raywood, and Arizona or Modesto. Modesto is a variety of Arizona. Raywoods and Fantex, you take the grass out, it's a death sentence. Arizona stands a better chance, but keep the grass. Look, I'm such a conservationist, and I really know in my heart that water is such a precious resource, but so's your tree. And if you take that out, you lose your tree. It's a big tree. I call them heritage trees. Your tree is helping my life because it's working as an outdoor evaporative cooler. It is cooling your yard more than any other, but it's cooling my city, right? And as we go through this process and we're taking out all this grass and losing so many mature trees, our city's heating up faster than it otherwise would, and it's heating up anyway. So we really need to conscientiously, thoughtfully push back against the heating of our city through the heat island effects and through climate change. So keep the grass. Maybe cut, you know, the root system. That tree's been growing in there for a long time, and it's extended way out past the edge of the canopy. So if you take a little bit of grass out, just a little bit, it might not affect it. But if you go in very far at all and take out grass or take it out completely, there's likely going to be decline and death, even with Arizona ash. What happens is they get really stressed out, and ashes are susceptible to a disease called sooty canker, which is a wind-borne aerial fungal disease. They're all exposed to it. Stress disease in plants is like stress disease in people. And I just got to say, people, please, please stop using artificial turf. Nothing's going to heat up your yard and our city faster than that. And it's full of plastic is toxic. You don't want to ingest it. It breaks down in the sun in this dry climate. It becomes airborne. You blow leaves off of it. You get leaves on it. It's like on carpet. You don't want leaves on your carpet. You blow it off. Those become airborne. They go in through your filtration system. You breathe it in. It goes through your skin. It is, I believe, an environmental, economical, and health disaster that we are doing. And I am frankly really upset with the SNWA that they would promote and pay people to take out grass and put in artificial turf. I think it's unconscionable, and I think it is a huge mistake. So thank you for telling me that.
Chris, thank you so much for that call. And we'll stay on the topic of trees and head to Bob, who has a question about his pomegranate trees turning yellow. Bob, welcome to the program.
Yeah.
Bob, can you hear us?
Yes. I'm not sure what kind they are, but like I said, 2 and 3 years old, and they were doing pretty good. I remember a couple years ago when it was 115, dried out, so I was giving it extra water this year, and now they're turning yellow and leaves dropping. I wonder if I get too much water.
Well, if you're watering like twice a day, it's staying saturated, then yes. Look, pomegranates are like the toughest of the fruit-bearing trees here in Southern Nevada. They're really well-suited for life here. But think of this. You know, little kids require a certain amount of water, not that much. You got to keep them hydrated. But when that kid turns 18, they drink a lot more water. They need a lot more water because they're bigger. The same's true of plants. Every leaf requires a certain amount of water. You get more leaves, your water needs increase. Now, you don't water more and more often because of what I said earlier. You're saturating the soil. It doesn't get oxygen. It can't pick up that water. What you do is you add emitters. You water wider as you grow. You plant a pomegranate, brand new baby pomegranate, say it's a 5 gallon, put 2 emitters on the root ball to keep that root ball wet. It'll wet some of that surrounding soil. But at the same time, I will put at least another 4 or 6 emitters around it, about 4, maybe 5 feet out, water for a long enough time, and those wetting patterns will overlap. And now that tree can put out its roots, get plenty of water, get more nutrients, and stay healthier much longer. Right. So I think that's because you're talking about it's responding negatively in hot weather. I'll bet you it's an issue of it's outgrown its wetting pattern. Are there plants at its base around it?
No, there's no plants around it.
So add some additional emitters. Do a hexagonal pattern. Go out about 4.5, 5 feet. Honestly, I'm not sure if it's 4 or 5 feet. But 5 feet, if you have a clay soil, 5 feet. If it's more sandy, 4 feet. So, but just put another ring of individual emitters. And 6 of them, so they'll be about 4 or 5 feet apart also. And it'll take time for that plant to get its roots out there. But it should do better next summer. The sooner you put it in, the sooner it'll start responding to that new wetting pattern and slowly grow its roots in. In the meantime, do some extra watering around the edge and encourage more root development. And to get her through this summer, and she'll survive. Honestly, they're so tough. You know, you might have a little dieback, whatever. She'll recover. But if you really want to help her out, throw some shade cloth over her too.
Bob, thank you so much for that call. Norm, let me ask you about cacti. Is it too early, too late in the year to plant a cactus?
No, and I don't think it ever is. Now, some cacti are more sun sensitive. So again, you know, we're still in pretty high solar radiation right now. You can even throw a little shade cloth over it. If it's a transplant from in the wild, like if you're it's not a true cactus, like a Joshua or a yucca or something, you know, it's really helpful if you know which side was facing south or whatever. So you plant it in the same facing because that's the tissue that's already acclimated to it. And the other consideration, if you're buying from a nursery, where was that grown? Well, you're probably not going to know. So if it was grown under shade cloth in San Diego, it's going to be, and you put it out in our really super intense sun, it's going to more likely struggle. You can also watch the plants. Sometimes, especially with cactus on, you know, that tissue will start to yellow. It'll start to yellow on the west side or the south side of the plant. And if after you plant it, if you just watch it pretty closely, look at it every day or two, and you see that yellowing, okay, yeah, it's responding to the sun. The tissue's yellowing out. You get some shade cloth on it or you set something in front of it, whatever. Get it some afternoon shade. Take some of that sun load off of it. That tissue will actually recover. If you let it go too long, then that tissue will burn and die, and then that will not recover. Eventually, the plant will, but that wound will be there. So the cool thing about cacti and succulents is they're really tolerant. They can go without water, so they're more likely to handle a new environment at these more stressful times of year.
Speaking of watering and taking care of plants, Ryan from Henderson has a question about day laurels. Ryan, you're on with Norm.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Thank you, Norm. I love listening to you.
Thanks,
I always feel like I know what I'm doing, and then like you said, dying off is part of it. So I'm glad to hear that. I used to have blueberry combs, and you know, because somebody called earlier was saying how we're getting advice from other drip sticks, and yeah, those things did horribly here and died off. So I got convinced to put in a bunch of bay laurels, and they were doing well at the beginning. I got about 6 in a, like next to each other, about a foot and a half between them. I can't now, you know, my development has some mature ones that they put in 2 years ago. They look great all through summer, through the heat. I don't see any brown and die off. All of mine, half the leaves are starting to get brown. I take them to Star. I take them to Moon. Those guys are very helpful. However, depending on who you talk to, they'll say, oh, you're overwatering. Oh, well, you're underwatering. It's stress. You need more. So Okay. Apparently they're brown because they have too much or too little water. And I'm like, well, okay, it's probably me.
So are they in full sun? Are they in full sun? Do they get a lot of afternoon sun?
Well, the tops of them, yeah, like they're near a wall.
Okay.
They're next to a wall. So, you know, the top, like 2 feet gets, you know, a lot of afternoon sun. But the other side of it browns out just as well. I mean, the whole around the tree, it's not okay. just that part.
So all right, I think I got it for you here. So bay laurels used to do much better here. As the heats increase, they have a harder time. They're much better suited in a more shady location. The way you can tell if it's a water problem or a sun problem, sun is more of a bleaching death of the tissue. It's faded on the edges. Water problems are going to be on the margin, the edge of the leaf or the tip of the leaf, and then the center will be more green. I'll tell you what, honestly, in a hot, sunny spot, I would actually prefer Japanese blueberries. But Japanese blueberries need a really good fertilization program that includes micronutrients. So if you email the station here, they'll send it on to me, and I can give you a little bit more detailed advice. But it's the micronutrients, chelated iron, chelated zinc, chelated manganese. Then the Japanese blueberries will do well. They'll take a lot more sun. Regardless, again, go back to that thing. They're pretty close to each other. They're all competing for water. If you can, add additional emitters outside. You're going to be watering where there are no plants, but there are plant roots there, or you're going to develop roots there. But the thing is, sometimes I see bay laurels in pretty hot situations. On the west side, where it's a little bit cooler, they seem to do better. More in the center of valley, especially the east side, they have more of a hard time. And then there's also individual plant variation. That's my thoughts on it.
Thank you for that question, Ryan. We also have this call from Sina from Las Vegas, has trying to take care of her trees, wants to know what she should do about possibly painting them. Sina, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks, Norm. Always very informative when you're on.
Thank you.
So I was at one of the nurseries, and I bought some paint that they advertised or promoted as if you paint the trunks of your trees, it protects them from creepy crawlers and other kinds of yuckies.
Does that say that on the label? Does it say that on the label? Oh, okay. All right.
No, it says it on the label. Yeah.
All right.
So I guess by that answer, you're not a fan.
Well, the one time to paint trees with a white latex paint, and I actually prefer to use a plant cloth, I can't think of the name. You buy rolls of this stuff that looks like toilet paper made for trees. You just wrap the trunk because then it goes away. But painting or wrapping is when a tree is new, and it can get sunburned. That trunk can get sunburned, and that can be an absolutely devastating damage. Even if it survives, you've set the plant back. So you paint when you first plant it. But just like our epidermal tissue, our skin, their trunks, their tissue will acclimate to the exposure. You just got to get them through the first summer or two. If you use paint, it should be a white latex paint. If this stuff is advertised for plants, then it should be fine to use. I don't know that painting trunks really has any effect on deterring insects. I guess there's probably some way that it does, but I wouldn't use it for that purpose. The only thing, if you have a mature tree, it's been there, don't paint it.
Norm, we've got a couple minutes left, and we've got this email from Penny in Ridgecrest. What do they mean by drought tolerant? I had some Calardia in my front yard, along with some gazinias. The Calardias are gone. I don't know whether I overwatered them or underwatered them, and some of my gazinias are not doing well either, although others are doing great, so I'm a little confused on how do you know how much water. Obviously, if it's wilting, you need to water, but otherwise, how do you know?
Gosh, boy, 35 years later, I'm still scratching my head on that one. and what really is frustrating is the ground is shifting beneath our feet. Plants that I thought, oh, this is a really drought-tolerant plant, it should be really heat-tolerant. That's not always true. And so as our heat is increasing, the water needs of the plants are increasing. Now, a plant established becomes more drought tolerant. It gets its roots out deeper. It gets them out wider if it has those water resources and if you don't water too often. So it's really a delicate act. But I got to tell you, man, Galardias and Gazanias in the summer, you pretty much got to water them every day. And I have both in my garden. And for every one that's growing there, there's more than one that's already died. they're beautiful plants, and so I'm willing to keep trying them. And you know, they're just very enchanting and bring a lot to the garden space. So you know, they're worth some failure, in my opinion. But yeah, and then there's other plants that are really drought tolerant. So drought tolerant is a moving bar. It's a relative thing. A desert willow, super drought tolerant. You water it, like, give it a good deep soak 3 times, 5 times a year. Same with the mesquites, Palo Verdes, Texas Rangers. You probably water those 5, 7 times a year. Cassias. But these smaller flowering plants sometimes require more. Then there's those that will rot out if you give them too much water, like Blackfoot daisy just doesn't do well. But in the case of Gallardia and Gazania, keep them moist through the summer. Yeah, unfortunately.
Norm, we've got about 4 minutes left. So let me ask you, at this point in the year, what should gardeners, landscapers be doing to make sure that their yard is in tip-top shape for next spring, early summer?
Well, avoid any extensive pruning, right? You can go in and deadwood any time of the year, take out deadwood, and that applies both to shrubs and trees. Again, this is something I approach like I do weeding. If there's a bunch of deadwood on a tree, I'll just go in there and prune some out, and I'm tired of it. That's okay. The deadwood's still there. I can get it on another day, right? Well, I think one of the practices that happens is mulch is organic matter on top of the soil. And so our shrubs, you know, if you have a hedge, the leaves will build up underneath there. Well, our gardeners go in there with blowers and blow them out. Well, that's mulch. That's actually helping the plant. That's what it naturally does, right? So leave that mulch in place. And here's the other thing. I just got to say, there is so much pruning that happens that just doesn't need to happen, right? You don't need to prune that plant into a ball. So there's different varieties of Texas Rangers, different sizes, range from 3 feet to 8 feet, right? If you got a 3, 4, 5 foot plant, a Texas Ranger, buy that variety. Don't get an 8 foot variety, because then you got to keep pruning it back and it's more work. And if you start shearing plants, you're taking away their beauty. I was driving to work. There's this community, the roadside strip, and these guys were just going after every single plant with their head shears. The plants are like 8, 10, 12 feet apart. The flowers are coming off of the Tacomas and laying there, and they're not going to bloom again for a while. There was absolutely no reason to do that. There's so much more pruning that happens than needs to happen. And unfortunately, we as consumers need to educate our professionals and say, no, it doesn't need to be pruned, right? And if they're not pruning it, those guys were getting paid, right? If they have less work, they can charge less, right? They feel they need to work. They need to prove their worth, right? But tell them, hey, back off. Leave my plants alone. I want them to look natural. Your garden, some people like that look, right? That's okay. That's up to you. But most plants are going to show their beauty more in their natural form. And then if a branch or two gets out of the way, just nip it off. And you can do that any time of the year. And then, you know, check your irrigation once in a while. It can really make a difference as well.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Norm, it is always so good to have you on the program.
Well,
thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Paul. It's great talking with you, too. Thanks for running things along here nicely.
State of Nevada is brought to you by the Journalists of Nevada Public Radio. It's produced and edited by Mike Prevett and me. Our board operator is Mason Udani, and Davis and Heidi Kaiser contribute stories. We're your local National Public Radio member station, whose main source of funding comes from listeners like you. If you'd like to find out more, visit knpr.org. I'm Paul Boger. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.